All right, well, I got volunteered to give this talk after I arrived here, so fortunately Elmer was kind enough to lend me some transparency, so a lot of what I'll be talking about today is thanks to him. Yeah, exactly. But it's a military sense of volunteer. So today I'm going to talk a bit about the problem that's been pointed to in super galaxies and quasars, that in almost all the observations that currently exist, there's generally no feature that's seen at 912 angstroms in the spectrum. And explaining this has been sort of a nightmare for accretion disk theorists who want to have thermal gas around a black hole that's causing the emission of the AGN in the optical and the ultraviolet. So I'm going to first talk about why theorists expected a Lyman edge in the past, and then show you some observations, and then talk about various ways to sort of fix up the theory to get rid of the Lyman edge, or maybe include more physics so that we can actually post-dict the fact that there are no Lyman edges. And then I'll finally talk about some possible future directions for this sort of research. And then Susie's going to also talk about some work that she's been doing on this problem. And if anyone else has some transparency to show or things to contribute, feel free to butt in. So this shows a prediction by in 1984 by Kolikalov and Sunyaev of what an accretion disk around a supermassive black hole should look like. These show face-on disks and more edge-on, and they've included they've taken Carew's stellar atmospheres, which include metal inopacies, hydrogen, helium, everything in non-LTE, and then they've folded this through a relativistic transfer function, taking the effective temperatures at different radii from the stellar atmospheres, and which gives the integrated accretion disk spectrum. And what you can notice here is that this is in units of log units of frequency over 10 to the 14th hertz. And you notice that here at 1,000 angstroms, or close to the Lyman edge, there's an abrupt drop in these spectra. And even at the Balmer edge, there's quite a strong jump as well. And so when these predictions first came out, Ski and some other observers were excited to go out and test these predictions and to see whether, when you looked in the ultraviolet and in the rest frame of quasars, whether you would see a sharp drop as predicted.
What's all that other stuff just to the red of the Lyman edge? Is that carbon?
I'm not sure exactly. I don't know the answer to that. I'll show some other calculations later in which iron, manganese, magnesium, and sulfur contribute quite a bit of opacity near the Lyman edge. But yeah, for these models, I'm not sure. So the observers went out and looked for this distinct signature of a drop at 912 angstroms. And what did they find? Well, this shows some recent observational data. The Lyman edge is right around here. And as you can see, the spectrum does not drop as predicted, but there does seem to be a change in the spectral slope. If you zoom in on the Lyman limit, oh, by the way, this is a composite quasar spectrum from a paper by Zhang et al. It's pretty recent. It's HST data. They've combined objects from different redshifts so that they can get a broad range of wavelength coverage near the Lyman edge. Yeah, Ski. Mm-hmm.
I'd just like to comment that, the composites don't have to obey the laws of physics.
So that's correct.
They also have this particular one has, there's rendering ambiguities and so on. Mm-hmm. The reason why you do composite is to get some signal to noise.
Right.
And I would just say that by far, in my opinion, the best thing to focus on for being noise-free and problem-free is the 3C273 spectrum.
I was about to show that, Ski.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's much
Yep. Okay, I'll just skip to that then, put that up, because it is pretty remarkable spectrum.
It's so much more robust.
Yeah, this shows the first quasar, 273.
Before I get that issue, is the claim here that uncertainties of reddening could make that change of slope go away into something?
I think that they could.
Possibly could.
Mm-hmm. I think that, and also cosmological absorption has to be corrected for it.
Yeah. And they do correct for that in doing this composite, but it's not clear how accurate that correction is for an individual object. You have to use an average, correction factor.
I
and there's some scattering that.
I think there's evidence that quasar continua are often significantly reddened, and there's no attempt made to de-redden the quasar continua there. So if you have a range of reddening, composite, God knows what that will do, especially down there where the dust absorption cross section is so high and so wavelength dependent. Just everything about it, it doesn't compare to this in robustness.
So this shows Orpheus observations of 3C273, and the Lyman edge is here, at the redshift of 0.158. And again, you can see that there's no distinct feature at that wavelength. There's quite a bit of absorption by intervening clouds and also some possible emission features which are labeled here. And this is our galactic absorption at 912 angstroms. And so as Ski said, this is robust argument that there's no feature in an individual object. There also exists some HUT data from various Seyfert galaxies. 1068, there's unfortunately these are quite low redshifts, so it's hard to get any photons greatly below the edge. If you look at the bottom two cases though, which are at a few percent, at z's of a few percent, you can see that these also don't appear to show any distinct feature at the Lyman edge. So in these other cases the redshifts are so low it's unclear whether this is whether the dips can be associated with the Seyfert galaxy or with intervening absorption.
Yeah, and not just in terms of discrete features, but in the previous spectrum, they cover 100,000 kilometers a second, and there's not even any broad thing going on.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it can be fit. Actually, in the 3C273 case, you can just fit it with just a straight line. Once you remove all the different, try to correct for the absorption features, and then you sort of smooth the spectrum, it's consistent with just something completely flat.
This looks like that too.
Sorry?
This looks like that.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. And here's some higher redshift objects, which are courtesy of Goodrich. These are from the HST archive. And so these are quasars, which again at the Lyman limit there appears to be no change at all. This one there might be some turn down, but it's not a very strong case for an edge at all. And this is generally the case. Now sometimes there are seen damp systems which do cause sharp edges near the Lyman limit, but those are, if they have a very narrow velocity feature, they're thought to be intervening absorption. So clearly the prediction that Kolokov and Sunyaev did not come true, or did not bear out in the observations. And so this led theorists to scramble for a reason why this is true. Now, mostly people working on this problem have tried to stay within the framework of a standard thin accretion disk because that has the ability to explain the spectrum peaking in the ultraviolet and the luminosity of quasars. So I'll then now show you a list of the different ways that people have tried to solve, get rid of the Lyman edge by including more physics.
There's also a similar problem with the Balmer edge.
That's right.
May I ask you about that? My superficial reading of the CV literature, as I have put it, is that that's more of a quantitative than a qualitative problem. In other words, we generally do see an outbreak, an absorption edge, and a quiescence and emission edge. It's a matter of you don't predict the degree right.
Yeah.
So I find that's different than
this. It's a zebra.
This is a qualitative.
I agree completely. Mm-hmm. The physics department is different. But the motivation was, you know, people who write review papers said that there's a problem with this feature because you have the Balmer edge in the jump in the Balmer in the cataclysmic and the Lyman in the gem.
Yeah.
I don't see it's really the same problem, but the motivation of making this model, this type of this model was solving the atmosphere type problem for the motivation of both the Balmer and the Lyman.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to work for the cataclysmic.
Yeah.
If you do the correct quote unquote vertical structure for the cataclysm variable, then you get almost no visible boundary.
But you do generally observe a substantial.
Yeah, but you just get enough of observation.
Oh, okay.
It reduces the one from the
right.
Stellar models to the one which is more or less correct.
Mm-hmm.
But the decrease is no more than a factor of several relative to
the. Yeah, I must remember that. But also, you're right, you see it in emission in the quiescence for low luminosity.
Right.
So it is more or less, I think it's more or less solved for the cataclysm.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like, reading, well, it's okay that you have this problem because cataclysmics have that problem and you know those are just. That always rings hollow to me just because of the qualitative versus quantitative.
Mm-hmm. But I like, well, I think, yeah, well, I'm not sure whether you can really say that there is a qualitative problem in that I think that, you know, with doing the radiation transfer properly in the disk structure, we do predict a rather small edge and, you know, what's seen is almost nothing. So anyways, I'll get back to that in a bit. So first of all, it was pointed out that the stellar, yeah, Ski, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Sorry,
no, that's fine.
I'm saying there's quantitative problems in the CV case with respect to the naive models,
okay.
Not even a quantitative problem with the models with more physics.
Mm-hmm.
And here you're saying there's a quantitative problem with respect to the, you know, the models that have the extra things and so on. But it's still not exactly enough.
Sure. Yeah. So the first thing that was pointed out after Kolokhov and Sunyaev made their prediction, and then the observers didn't see these edges, was that the effective gravities that were used in for stellar atmospheres were much too high to be appropriate for quasar accretion disks. And a lower gravity means that you have a lower density, and a lower density changes the ionization balance. And so several papers then went on to point this out in later years. And also, it was pointed out that assuming the disk was LTE could also produce too large of an absorption feature, including non-LTE effects, could change the ionization balance and reduce the edge as well.
That's
sorry?
The
I think they were in LTE still atmospheres, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
And the surface gravity difference, how much? And how robustly are the quasar disks lowered in surface gravity? Klitlov and Sunyaev actually said in their paper that they thought that the surface gravities from supergiants that they were using were
low. They were low enough?
No, the surface gravity is okay, but it's increasing with 5 degrees.
Well, that,
that's
well,
one thing, yeah. But you don't.
It's not there, but also it restricted their. You're not going to like this. It just restricted their choice of alpha. They could choose alphas, which I believe were very low.
Small, yeah. So they had higher densities.
And get appropriate stellar atmosphere.
Yeah.
Because this is not a stellar atmosphere, because it's not really an equilibrium, so you can cheat this.
So what factor was involved in terms of converting their alphas to the currently favored alphas?
There are no current alphas. This is all garbage.
Okay.
Alpha is garbage. I mean, there are no currently favored alphas.
Okay.
If you expect that the magnetic field is going to be, you know, roughly of order equipartition with the you know, gas or radiation pressure, then alpha is one. But we don't know how it scales in these sorts of disks.
But I think that what they were taking alphas 3 or less.
I believe that's correct. Yeah, they were rather small.
Yeah,
But if we had to guess based on Hall simulation, we would guess.
They get 0.05 for alpha, but it seems to be changing with the resolution of their simulations. And they didn't include the radiation pressure in the simulations, which can affect quasar accretion disks because their radiation is strong. Yeah, but the radiation pressure may, radiation can maybe affect the structure of the disk, and that might affect the magnetic pressure. Sorry?
I agree completely with the
magnetic. Yeah.
So,
I would be less violent than Omar, but in general, I think he's right. Maybe Alpha is not right. I should be very, very careful.
Yeah. Okay, so Greg Shields had it. Sorry, yeah, go ahead, Steve.
To what extent is true, as you sort of said in the setting paper, that everyone knows that K and F gravities were too low? That's fair statement or exaggeration.
What do you mean everybody knows?
Excuse me. In other words, the papers that have both lower surface gravity suggested that the KNF alphas were implausibly low. In other words, that they were poor choices just because that was all that was available in terms of discovered libraries and so on, those
sort of
gravity. I was just wondering whether that's a defensible statement. I think that is, yeah. But I
think, now we're doing the full accretion disk structure calculations with, doing atomic physics properly, I think. And again, it does depend on the guess for alpha. Although it does, people have looked at different choices of alpha and it doesn't seem to be as strong a dependence as maybe you would have expected from the Kolokov and Sinyaev calculations.
So in this calculation, you must assume the stabilization is not alpha, but you're probably taking proportional to the pressure.
That's right.
And then, of course, it implies that the stabilization of viscosity, which is totally arbitrary, it's worse than alpha.
Right? Yeah.
And also, when you say you're doing it correctly, that also, you have to face the question of instability and whether there's two phases.
That's right.
So
yeah.
Like the physics is now going to be correct.
Right. Yeah.
You need to bear in mind that what counts is the net gravity, which is the effect of radiation pressure subtracted off from gravity. And you can easily see why that's going to be tiny, because we're talking about the radiation pressure support as part of the disk. So you might argue to a first approximation that's going to be zero. So that's why you need a good vertical structure solution, because there's going to be a very fine tuning. You know, in our simple estimates, orders of magnitude, the net gravity was two or three orders of magnitude less than the nominal vertical gravity GZ. And so it might even be hard to look at some stellar atmosphere grid and even know, what the net gravity really was at the surface.
That also touches on the instability issue, right? Because if you the radiation pressure dominated, then you're unstable.
Well, it depends on what you assume for the viscosity. Yeah. And that we don't really understand.
There are other radiation pressure.
That's true, yeah.
It's not helpful,
right.
I think more basic is the division of the flux is not equal to zero, it's equal to the unknown function of the pipe. So you can have very good atomic physics, molecular physics, and everything. And the big unknown, which is usually say, okay, let's assume this is proportional to the pressure. Then you can solve the equation. The only reason is
and
then you solve the vertical structure equation.
Yeah, but this is a qualitative problem that needs to be right.
I think it's probably okay, but just a personal feeling and belief. Somebody can say that already, but why are you bothering doing that? It's totally arbitrary. What if the
discovery
is doing this?
Because you're trying to
solve
a qualitative problem.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and then, yeah, I agree. And as Ski has pointed out, and some other people have, this, the changing the surface gravity is a fine-tuning problem, because you need to, first of all, this shows the flux versus frequency and 10 to the 16th hertz, so the Lyman edge is right here. These show different log surface gravities, and you can change the surface gravity in log by a small amount, and the edge goes from quite strong emission to strong absorption. So somehow a quasar has to find a surface gravity which is just right to have the edge also be canceled out. And so this is a big problem, because we don't...
It's a linear scale.
Yeah,
sorry?
Yeah, in order to...
Wait. No. This really gets to me. This is not a fine-tuning problem.
Right.
You're looking at a particular annulus in the disk with a particular temperature. And yes, you know, you alter the effect of gravity and you can turn the edge into emission or absorption. But this, you know, if you sum over annuli with that, which have emission edges and absorption edges, you're going to get something which...
That helps by a factor schedule, perhaps.
Yeah. It's sort of a random walk.
You never claims that this is the way that, you know, that 3.85 curve is the solution to the Lyman edge problem.
No, but that's...
But this is an annulus,
right? No, this is an annulus.
But that's
right. That's right. Yeah, sorry. This is just one particular annulus. Yeah.
That was something from that will reduce it probably by a factor of several depending on the parameters. But still, when you look at this thing, even if you grant you the factor of several, I still think this is pretty amazing that the surface gravity... Well, that would say the surface gravity has to be 3.85 plus or minus 0.05. I'll grant your argument and say it has to be 3.85 plus or minus 0.15.
Okay, if we just have a single temperature atmosphere and no relativistic effects and nothing else.
Right, that's a multi-annular thing. I'll give him a factor of 3 for that.
Okay, thanks. And so, let's see. And then Greg Shields' student, I forget his first name, Howard Coleman, had a nice plot in his thesis of the maximum temperature in a disk versus L over L Eddington, and found that, this I believe was a non-LTE calculation, and found that at lower temperatures you get a strong absorption edge, which is what you expect because of the higher ground state abundance of hydrogen, and then as you increase the temperature or increase the accretion rate, the edges become weaker, and then finally switch to become emission edges, and then at very high temperatures you get a weak emission edge because now all the hydrogen is, you know, completely ionized. So now also, let's see, was his thesis non-LTE? I forget. He did an LTE structure calculation and a non-LTE radiative transfer. Yeah. Okay. Now, more recent work by Hubany and Hubany shows the different effects, different physics included in computing still atmospheres. The dash shows just a simple black body at this effective temperature. This is R over RG of 4. It's for a Kerr accretion disk. RG is GM over C squared. Then the green curve shows an LTE computation for the structure of the atmosphere and the radiative transfer. Then he shows various approximations for non-LTE, but the most complete is this red curve. And you can see that the Lyman edge is decreased for these particular parameters. So in some cases, including non-LTE effects, does seem to change the ionization structure near the surface and can cause the edge to decrease. There's also a decrease due to simply modified blackbody, which it causes the effective photosphere to be deeper in the disk. And so across the edge, there's where the radiation is coming from is less ionized, and so there's less of a change in opacity across the edge.
How relevant is this? This is at one radius.
Yeah, it's one annulus. That's right.
A very small area.
I'll get to that in a little bit.
Just an example, but it's not relevant for the observed spectrum.
I'll get to that in a bit. Yeah. And again, this you know, green curve can shows LTE and the red shows non-LTE in this case for a higher effective temperature, and the edge is reduced quite a bit in this case from emission to
relevant, you know, particular annulus.
Yeah.
Probably
we
just simulated
the
micro lens and crossing,
because
then maybe you predict dramatically increased amplitude.
Yeah. Okay. And I've actually done that calculation, but I didn't bring it with me. But you can see the edge change somewhat during a micro lensing event.
I haven't done that yet, of course.
Yeah, but there are some the target of opportunity stiff observations during a micro lensing. Yeah.
Eric, if I try to summarize what I saw just now.
Yeah.
Low enough temperature, you have an absorption edge. High enough temperature, that can go into emission.
Right.
But at this still higher temperature of 80,000 degrees, it looked like the laminate of hydrogen went away.
That's right. Yeah.
That is, the hydrogen is completely zapped.
Yeah, and the and because the temperature in the photosphere is so high, the the opacity is much smaller across the edge. That's right. Okay, so the question is, does all this work in practice? And the problem is the uncertainty in alpha and computing the viscosity of the disk in terms of structure of the disk. So that sort of hampered the progress in really making robust predictions about what accretion disk should look like. Now, another proposal for reducing the Lyman edge comes from just the fact that we see strong X-rays in Seyfert galaxies, which have been modeled by a corona above the disk. And that corona then should compensate the photons coming from the cool accretion disk. And as it does that, then it takes lower energy photons, compton up, scatters into higher energy. And so any features then are going to be smoothed out by the effect of the lower energy photons filling in any absorption edge above the Lyman edge. So in a paper by Czerny and Zabrowski, sorry, I can't pronounce it, Zabrowski, they use a temperature of 10 to the 8, even pulse. They use a temperature of 10 to the 8 Kelvin and an optical depth of order unity. And what they found was they were able to reduce the size of an absorption edge by quite a bit, so it was nearly undetectable. And I think there could be several problems with this calculation. Sure, yeah.
Constant scattering was only one.
Unity, yeah.
Then 1/3 of the photon should on unscattered.
That's right, yeah.
So why don't we see a 1/3 size edge?
Because you're also filling in, you're taking these lower energy photons and giving them a boost to higher energy. So they're filling in this flux up here. It's a smoothing process, yeah.
That should not reduce in and of itself, reduce the edge at all.
Yeah.
Changes the continuum in the neighborhood of the edge.
This is also just a vertically averaged. I don't know what inclination angle that they're looking at. This is temperature. This is temperature.
Oh, that's
not inclination angle. And I don't know which inclination angle this is being looked at. But that can also affect that. Yeah.
And you've got to be careful. Is this Monte Carlo?
Oh, and this is also long.
How did they actually
did this by using an analytic approximation to, it's basically a kernel for Compton scattering. So they took the intrinsic spectrum and then convolved it with this kernel and got the final spectrum. Yeah, but there have been more careful calculations. This is just the first. Did you have something to say, Steve?
Sorry, yes.
Yeah.
In that Luminate thing,
sure,
what they showed was that they got a smaller Lyman edge by far, but a huge helium plus Lyman edge. And we have observed some quasars at the helium plus Lyman edge. And, you know, they predict a huge emission thing in helium plus Lyman edge. And what you see when you observe quasars there is, if anything, a tiny deficit, which causes people to say they detected the Gunn-Peterson effect.
Right.
5% deficit.
Yeah.
Well, how does that square with this model?
Well, again, let's see. Okay, I guess two things. There's one case, a recent Stiff's observation, in which Yvonne fit some of his atmospheres to that. particular observation. And in that case, I believe that the there wasn't a huge emission feature, but the temperatures of his atmospheres were much lower. And so I think that, sorry?
What does that do to the liner?
I don't recall what it did in that case.
But it would be nice to have both. And you can't get rid of the helium by hydrogen by saying it's going to mm-hmm. put the lime
edges
because you're not
going to
turn
the space. Right. The helium plus. No, I agree. I believe, though, even for these lower temperature disks, that the lime edge was not very strong once you put in, you know, pulled it through the relativistic effects. No, I actually was going to look at that paper and I ran out of time. So. Yeah. It's a recent AstroPH, so I can give you the reference if you want to look at that. Yeah. Okay, so now I think there's a couple of different problems with compensation. One is what Doug pointed out, that if, you know, tau is over order unity, some of these photons are still going to escape and you still see an edge. But in a similar sense, you also need a covering fraction of order unity in order for this to work, because if the corona is not covering the entire disk, then the regions which are uncovered are simply going to escape and you'll see an edge there from there. But I believe that if in models of a corona which causes the X-ray production of the X-ray spectrum in which the covering fraction is of order unity, then this produces an X-ray power law which is too soft compared to the rather hard power law seen in Seyfert galaxies. So this may be a problem for compensation. Another problem is that the X-rays from the corona are also going to come down to the disk and heat the surface layers of the disk, and that tends to produce a strong Lyman emission edge because of the temperature inversion at the surface of the disk. This shows a calculation by Sensel and Krolik. It's an LTE integrated over the disk, including relativistic effects. It's a mass of 2.7 times 10 to the 8 solar masses and various accretion rates. They assumed the viscosity for this case, TRFE proportional to equal to 0.1 square root of P rad times P gas. And you can see that there's quite a strong edge that should be detected at the Lyman edge in all of these models. So
this is now a log scale.
This is a log nu L nu versus
it's
log nu.
Order of magnitude.
Yeah, it's basically a huge jump that would be impossible to miss. Now, one thing that does need to be done is to include non-LTE effects in this calculation and to do the compensation and the illumination of the disk self-consistently. So, in other words, to do the radiative transfer through the disk and the corona simultaneously. And that's something that we'd like to work on eventually.
But see, this also gets to the question of vertical structure
mm-hmm. yeah.
of the dissipation
right.
raised already.
That's right.
Has anybody done the calculation? Just a cold disk, no dissipation in the disk, hot corona, all the dissipation in the corona, according to...
Oh, yeah, sorry. That's what this calculation is.
So there's no dissipation.
Yeah, there's no dissipation in the disk. Yeah. Yeah.
So it doesn't work. That's pretty clear.
That's right. Yeah. Now, that is a good point, because in the case... I think it may be a little extreme to have all the dissipation in the corona and none in the disk, just because, you know, you have to have all the magnetic flux escaping from the disk,
but
it spans a range of models. But it'd be nice to look at, maybe some where you have some dissipation in the disk, because that's going to strongly change the density in the surface gravity, which will strongly affect that edge.
Observationally, we know that a negligible fraction of the flux, I would say, mm-hmm. a very small fraction, is constant on, say, a viscous time scale or even a sound crossing time scale. That says it's all internal.
Externally illuminated, yeah. Mm-hmm. You said of order all the flux?
Yes.
And Seyfert galaxies?
And I would argue quasars. Quasars, in a matter of a few years, which is zero time,
mm-hmm.
you see a UV variability of a magnitude or so,
mm-hmm.
and increasing with frequency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So, let's see. So, another proposal for getting rid of the Lyman edge, which was considered by Kolokayev and Sunyaev, but several other people have done calculations on, is looking at the Doppler broadening and the relativistic smearing due to the fast gas around the inner edge of the disk. And what's actually been found is rather interesting. I think that for Kerr holes, this is much more effective because the velocities are so much greater near the inner edge of the accretion disk. Also, you need, in order for this to be effective, you can't be looking at a disk directly face on because in that case, there's no velocity or Doppler boosting. There's simply just the gravitational redshift. And if you believe that secret ones are more face on.
If you want to be pedantic, there's no second order contributions.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, that's correct. And if you believe that secret ones are more face on than secret twos, then in secret ones, you should believe that you'd see a redshifted feature, which, as I showed you, that there wasn't any evidence for in the current Hutt data. And also Schwarzschild black holes, which are face, if they're face on, are not very effective at smearing the Lyman edge. But I have done some calculations of the Hubeni accretion disk models and put in the relativistic effects, and this shows different inclination angles. This is the parameters are listed down at the bottom, and as you can see, there's almost never do you expect the feature just at the Lyman edge. There's always either some redshift in this case, or strong blue shift in the almost edge-on case, and there also appears to be in these models a change in slope that occurs roughly around the Lyman edge. Now, we haven't taken these and tried to fit them to spectra yet. I mean, to observe spectra, but this sort of indicates that you may be seeing these objects. I mean, if you believe these are accretion disks, you may be seeing them more edge-on than expected.
It would also be good to keep in mind that
Bomber
edge, because it's less subject to all these effects.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't bring a plot of that.
What does the Bomber edge look like?
It actually, in these cases, is rather weak because, in these atmospheres, there's almost nothing at the Bomber edge because of the temperature being so high. For this particular model, that was also the case.
There's
no feature. Yeah, so it's coming from larger radii. Yeah,
and
that's where that's right. Yeah.
But isn't that don't you get a lot of volume?
Yeah, but this thing, I mean, depending on if it's reasonably close to face on, like the payoff does indicate, it's out in a region of the disk where. There's lower velocities and so on. It means that whatever the VLR does, it has to have this superposed on it. And so it still could be constraining.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see the plot, but I think it could be.
Okay, then. So I think it may be a problem that in order to use Doppler broadening to get rid of Lyman edge, you need a more edge-on disk. Especially since iron K alpha line observations of Seyfert galaxies might be indicative of more face-on disks, and also the fact that you might need large spin in order to have it be strong enough.
Indicative of small spin, is that a robust statement?
Which
some sources, the K alpha line indicates low spin. Is that a fair statement?
I don't think that's a fair statement. There's the problem is that as people at GLO pointed out, you can either have a Schwarzschild disk, which is just being illuminated, versus a Kerr disk, which it goes in further. Okay, so I think the next solution is a lot more radical in that it just throws out the whole thin disk, standard thin, optically thick accretion disk picture. Instead, they have sort of a spray of small clouds, which it's not really clear what geometry they have or what dynamics they obey. But The advantage with having a bunch of small clouds is that they can each be sort of optically thin, and you can arrange them to be small enough that and hot enough that they can still produce enough emission. And so I did calculation of what that would look like. This shows just a optically thin one-dimensional rate of transfer calculation with different temperatures and densities assumed in a paper by Barbanis, 1993, density of 10 to the 15th, electron density of 10 to the 15th per centimeter cubed, and a height that gives an optical depth that's about 0.1 Thomson. So this shows log nu F nu versus log nu. The black curve shows what gas at 10 to the 5th Kelvin should look like. And in that case, there's quite a strong Lyman emission edge, which is a factor of 10 or so. So again, same problem as in the X-ray illuminated case, because in these cases are rather similar, because they're, in both cases you have rather hot, optically thin gas that's doing the emission. And the red curve shows a 10 to the 6th Kelvin assumption for the temperature, and this has about a 25% jump. So this again would be detectable, and you need some other mechanism to smear it out. And Barbanis appealed to the relativistic broadening or compensation or some of these other effects to smooth out this edge in this particular model. So I think the problem with this is that again it does predict strong edges, and also I think the bigger problem is that there's not been enough theoretical work to determine what the dynamics or what sort of equations this gas would obey, and how to pressure confine them, and how to construct sort of quasi-equilibrium out of that. There's been recent work by Julian Krolik on this. However, his model actually has much bigger clumps than were assumed in these particular models. So his model would actually look, the spectrum would look quite a bit different. So,
the present members of this program, whether anyone here, what the reaction is to that model? And indeed, the calculation by Charles Gammy. I mean, all of you people who are working on the ADAPS and on transitions from cold to hot flows, does anyone have any comments?
Well, Julian's model is, applicable to high accretion rate cases, because that's when you have the radiation pressure instability. Okay.
Well, I don't know. My complaint is that he got up in Sweden, as you remember this, and started talking about, well, no one's looked at thermal instability in a long time in a careful way. And he asked Christine, don't raise your hand, and said, but what if the phenomenon he said, this looks hard when they're low luminosity. And he said, well, this is all around. And then she said, well, that's a phenomenon. Thermal instability simply do not apply.
Yeah. But I think he constructed this model.
I don't know if when this looks, at least for galactic, when this looks cold, optically thin.
He did construct this model with Seyfert galaxies in mind. But,
still.
And in those cases, we don't know what state it's in. But,
What about the Gammy thing?
Yes, Ethan, about that during the conference, his reservations. I can't remember the detail now, but he was concerned, I think. Does Gammy include the shearing?
No, it's a completely static model with a vertical magnetic field and then struck by gravity.
He had concrete reasons that I forget now why he thought the shearing could be very hard on that. And he drew an analogy to the question of magnetic fields in disks. And I'm sorry that I can't remember more details, but there was an earlier calculation involving magnetic fields, and the shearing was critical to that. And he thought somehow, qualitatively, a similar thing would apply here.
You see, there's some. I'm attracted to these ideas because there is a big difference between black hole disks and disks around CD, and that's what you have this radiation pressure dominated zone. And if we're facing a lot of problems and given the observation, this might be a key difference. And if there's an indication that there are really dynamic instabilities that are operating in this portion of the flow, then it could make a huge impact on the spectrum. Very few people are exploring.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one project that Julie and I are planning to work on, is to try and look at radiation with MHD and see how you can, you know, how that affects the viscosity in the disk, because this proposed mechanism for damping damping magnetosonic waves with radiation damping.
But it'd be interesting. Not just the viscosity mechanism, but the whole disk structure.
Yeah.
Very different from what we I'm not interested in the thermal instability. There are indications that there are dynamic instabilities that might be operating here.
Mm-hmm.
That.
Yeah.
Sorry. What like the photon bubble.
Photon bubble, which is sort of, it's effectively convection.
Theoretical.
I was at least of AGN are telling you that there's a big problem with it.
Because the variability is so much faster than you expect.
I'm talking about the galactic object in which you have a characteristic of in the center. Don't look at the thing. It's exactly the same problem. And they seem to be very happy.
What do you mean expect them to break?
They're not wrong in the way you expect them to.
Yeah, and the behavior seems to show that they have a very nice structure to resonate.
But Mike, you mean by expect them to be wrong, you mean that they should be stable at low accretion rate and unstable at high accretion rate?
Yeah, high accretion rate, they look nice and happy
and quiet. Yeah, even better.
But at high accretion rate, let me understand this. At high accretion rates, your handle on the spectrum is a very narrow window. You're looking at the soft X-rays and you see very little of most of the accretion disk. Am I right?
Mike gave a whole talk on this yesterday. Oh. And it was really good, and it'll be on the web. So
okay.
I can see a lot more than we can put in.
In the very high state, you see the disk spectrum.
Luminosity is
maximum.
I'll see you.
She's going to actually. Yeah. She's going to talk after I give the summary. Okay. Then the final thing that's been looked at is the effect of metal lines on the opacity, and Ivan Hubany has, you know, the still atmosphere code that he's applied to disks, and he has the option of just turning a knob and turning on all these metal line opacities, including the physics there. And so far, all he's done is computed the structure of the disk, assuming hydrogen and helium are the only contributors to the opacity. And, you know, the metals are sort of a background for the density. And then after he's computed that structure, then he does the radiative transfer and turns on the metals, assuming that they're in LTE with the density and temperatures computed from that structure of the disk. So the hydrogen and helium are in non-LTE, the metals are in LTE, and the metals are not included in computing the disk structure. And when he does so, this is what he finds. First of all, you have to assume a broadening for the lines, which he takes to be 30 kilometers per second, which is fairly small. So, compared to what's expected for turbulent velocities in disks, it may be reasonable. And the dashed lines show the predictions with just hydrogen and helium. You can see the Lyman edge here. In some cases, it's small. In some cases, it's larger for this particular disk. And then the solid line, of course, shows the effect of metal lines. most of the transitions in here are due to iron, manganese, magnesium, and sulfur. And so you can see that this is one large effect that has been ignored in previous models. And the metal ions have enough opacity that in some cases where there's a strong edge, they simply erase any observable feature due to the Lyman edge.
And the they
That's right. Yeah. But they were looking at, again, different parameters for them.
Well, that brings up
For temperature and for the surface gravity.
That brings up the question that has built in some huge supersonic turbulence, and that's why the metal.
Why is this supersonic?
Well, I'm asking.
Oh, no, it's not supersonic. This is actually quite subsonic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
I should say, we know from supernova there's a huge effect of the velocity gradient on the effective opacity of the metal line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you should include all gradients.
Oh, I completely agree. It's just difficult to do.
It's going to go up like crazy.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's difficult to do, though. First of all, we don't understand the turbulence, so we have to sort of clue that and put that in hand. And then the shear. Right, the shear is going to affect it as well. Yeah, and that makes it more complicated because then you have to do you have to include the phi dependence in the radiative transfer. And I've, you know, I've come up with schemes to do that, but we haven't implemented it yet because it's difficult to do.
So,
yeah, well, that's what we were planning to do, where we just put in a quadrupole moment for the the velocity,
right.
And then we can do the the radiative transfer.
No,
and Yvonne actually has it. And then, well, the other thing is that we have not, or he has not yet included these opacities in computing the disk structure. And so if you look at the total spectrum, flux is not conserved yet. So really what needs to be done is a line blanketed calculation where they, where you include the proper turbulent broadening. This shows log nu versus log f nu versus log nu. The dotted lines are for just hydrogen and helium. This includes the relativistic effects. It also integrates over all radii out to gravitational radius of 50 RG, which includes all the flux that's relevant near the Lyman edge. You can see flux is not conserved. The green line shows the calculation with these LTE metals included in the radiative transfer. Down below is zoomed in and plotted against lambda, these two models again. This shows no metals, hydrogen, helium. This shows with metals. And you can see that there still is somewhat of an absorption feature at the Lyman edge. This is for a face-on model, so this is sort of the worst case as far as relativistic effects go. This is also for A of 0.998, so there is strong Doppler shifts because it's a curved disk. And, well, Omer showed this to Anuradha Karatkar, who's done a lot of these observations of Lyman edges with SPI, and she claims that you could still detect this sort of feature in the spectrum.
Well, now,
Yeah, that's right.
By a factor of 7.
Yeah.
And that looks a lot less like a quasar than the top one. And in fact, there's a way of striking out the way that...
Yeah, Ski, I wouldn't trust... Okay, yeah, first of all,
okay.
I agree. I wouldn't trust these calculations. I'm just saying that's an important effect.
I accept that that's not definitive, but to get a feeling for where this research is going to lead, you could say, let's arbitrarily crank up the equivalent width of the metal lines and see if it ever looks like a quasar spectrum.
Okay, that's good.
And the answer is it won't, because I think the more metal opacity, the worse it looks, and the more you kill off the ionizing photons.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
What was the level of the abundance of the metals?
It's assumed to be solar. So,
What kind of change do you think it will need if you take a non-empty view?
For the metals?
Yes.
I don't know enough about this to say what will happen. Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, Yvonne does have the capability in his code to do that calculation, to do line blanketed, with all these different levels included. But it is computationally expensive. It's something that he plans to work on. Okay, so that ends the laundry list of different or possibilities. I guess I'll skip to the end, the future directions and challenges.
I didn't quite understand what's wrong with the solution number 3.
Oh, okay. continentizations? Oh, it's definitely going to be effect. The problem is that in the cases that I've calculated, if you have a disk that's two face on, then you do see a redshifted absorption or emission feature. Sorry? I was trying to come up with a quantitative way to look at that, and really it's hard to say because you have to put in the atmospheres that you compute for each radius and then fold it through relativistic transfer, and it's kind of hard to go backwards. So I think really what's going to need to be done is to take these spectra, fit them to quasar spectra, and then see what inclinations are allowable and can still give the correct spectrum to you.
And both these conditions are satisfied together?
Sorry?
Both these conditions are satisfied together?
We're going to have to do that through fitting, but it does, I mean, when A is zero, then the edge does appear to be a lot stronger. So,
but remember, for inclination in that case, think that they're uniformly distributed between 0 and 30 degrees, according to solid angle, those inclinations.
150.
Yeah.
You think as much as 50? I've heard.
Well, and I don't know whether you can believe those inclinations either, actually, because if there's a contribution from, torus or something at larger radii with smaller velocity, that can lead to a mislead.
Against those 5 and 7 and 6.4, some of them are with lower.
Yeah. Yeah, but that doesn't indicate that they should be face-on, which is a problem for this. And there's actually a proposal that Omer and myself, are you on that ski? To look for iron K-alpha, cases where there's both an iron K-alpha line and data around the Lyman edge, and then we can hopefully compare those and see, using both, what constraints we can get on the inclination of the disk. So I think that would be exciting. So I'll just skip to the conclusions. I guess future computations and future challenges that I see should be looked at. First of all, for just standard thin accretion disks, I think we need to try to include the continentization. This I guess is in the case of very hot disks, and look at how vertical stratification of the dissipation affects the spectrum. Because if you put a lot in the surface layers, you can get a higher temperature in the surface layers of the disk, and then maybe that can affect the spectrum and maybe reduce the Lyman edge. We'll have to see. Then the metal line blanketing calculation, which I referred to, and then I think we need to start taking some of these serious calculations and comparing them with the observations and see if they really do rule out these models, as Ski believes they will. And I don't know yet whether that will happen. There will be a lot of data coming in from PEWS, and so it will be nice to compare that with these calculations.
Remind us when?
PEWS is being launched this year. Yeah. It's actually in May, because that's when the travel agent said that Warren Moose had to go down to Florida. Okay, so let's see. Then I think it's time to look at non-standard disks, which of course are computationally more difficult to deal with. I think two-phase disks should be looked at, and slim disks I think are also promising, because then you can have much stronger relativistic effects and concentrate the flux in a much smaller region where relativistic effects will be more important. These both involve, I think, 2D radio transfer, and that's why I think they haven't been looked at yet.
It's doable, as we were talking about earlier. It's doable and ought to be done.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Isn't it slim disk for this, but it can still be treated with 1D radio transfer?
Well, because the HRR is approaching unity in the inner parts.
But that's why they're called slim.
Another calculation that I think should be done is the proper, I mentioned this before, but just the proper X-ray illumination plus the disk structure at the same time during the full radio transfer, and nonlinear feedback properly. And that's actually a problem that Omer and I are planning to work on in Susie as well. And then finally, I think the root of all these problems is sort of understanding how viscosity works in this and what that ends up giving you as far as the equilibrium. So I think what's going to be needed to be done is
hard problems, right.
10 years. Desimulations with radiation, I think, is what needs to be done to find out how the stress, find out whether there's these disk instabilities that occur, and find out, you know, whether the magnetic field is going to create outflows or maybe produce non-thermal emissions, so maybe we don't have to worry about the Lyman edge because of that. So I think, anyways, I don't talk about that anymore. That's a difficult problem. And then another problem for the viscosity is simply modeling the plasma physics. This is more relevant for ADAS, I think, but there's been some analytic work recently which probably needs to be extended to numerical calculations of because turbulence is nonlinear, and how you damp it is it's going to be, you have to put in, you can't do it by hand, you have to do it numerically. I think looking at dissipation due to reconnection and flares in a corona is important, and there's a recent paper by Romanova that looked at loops above disks and reconnection in those by the loops getting stretched and then folded on themselves. And I think that their model was somewhat ad hoc. They just had fixed slip points. So really, you're going to need to do the disk plus the corona at the same time with full MHD. But
how difficult is
it
in the sun?
Yeah, you can't even understand the sun, much less disk. Yeah, unless you hope that for some reason the parameter space and for disks is somehow easier to simulate, but I can't see why that would be true. And I think another promising thing to look at would be to look at a two-temperature corona that's coexisting with an accretion disk in the center, which Mike showed for the very high state, although I guess your corona didn't necessarily have to be two-temperature. But I think that trying to construct a model with that sort of property is an important problem to look at as well. So thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing. And I think Susie's going to talk now about her calculations of the Lyman edge.